have Ken's expertise and great perspective of tuberculosis in the United States and in the world. One of the biggest stories in tuberculosis in the last 20 years has been the rise of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, that is TB that's resistant to the two most effective currently available drugs. And I think no group has been more forceful in advocating for the evaluation, the management, the testing for multidrug-resistant tuberculosis than Partners in Health. And so we're very fortunate to have Carol Mitnick here from Partners in Health and Harvard University to address this. Carol's been a powerful advocate for MDR treatment as well as one of the leading investigators in MDR-TB. So, Carol.
Thanks, Bill, and thanks to APHA and the colleagues from Denver Public Health, in particular Dave, for this opportunity. Here is my disclosure statement. I am on the scientific advisory board of Otsuka Pharmaceuticals. I have no equity in this privately held company, nor do I have any equity in the World Health Organization. I'm going to talk a little bit about an overview of the epidemiology of tuberculosis and drug-resistant tuberculosis globally. I'm going to talk a little bit about the failures to develop adequate knowledge and tools to address this age-old scourge. We'll use some specific examples of how entrenched, primarily structural inequalities. Ken talked a lot about individual level inequalities, but I also want to talk some about the structural inequalities contribute to these failures and how these inequalities persist. I'm going to use MDR-TB or multidrug-resistant tuberculosis sort of as an example, but much of what I say is relevant to all forms of TB, tuberculosis on its own, TB co-infection with HIV. It's just really as an example. And then I will provide an example of a model that can be used to try to remedy some of these structural and individual inequalities and bring treatment to larger numbers of people. So I'm going to go through this quickly. Ken talked a lot about the global epidemiology of TB, but just to highlight that looking at the distribution of the burden of disease, so about 85% of all cases of tuberculosis are in Asia and Africa, and about 80% of all cases annually are found in 22 countries. Only two of those countries are considered high by the Human Development Index that the World Bank uses, which is a way of classifying rich and poor or degrees of inequality. So it's just to note that 20 of those 22 are low or mid Human Development Index countries. Multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, as Bill noticed, tuberculosis caused by organisms resistant to the two most powerful anti-tuberculosis drugs. Resistance to TB drugs is pretty much as old as the treatment of tuberculosis. The very first formal randomized clinical trial was of tuberculosis, of the use of streptomycin in the 1940s for tuberculosis. And although early results showed that patients benefited dramatically from the introduction of streptomycin, those benefits were short-lived. And beginning at about 6 months, the results of the two groups, the streptomycin group and the placebo group, converged, and virtually all of the patients died, and those who, on their way to death, their organisms developed resistance to streptomycin. So we now know that there are about 500,000 new cases of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis each year. Those data come from a limited number, the data used to create that estimate come from a limited number of countries, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So here's just a visual of the distribution of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis in the world. The map on the left is among new cases, and the map on the lower right is among previously treated cases. You'll notice that although the color scheme is the same, the scales are slightly different, as the proportion of cases that are drug-resistant tends to be higher among previously treated cases than among new cases. The places with the highest resistance are in both new and previously treated are in in the former Soviet Union and in other parts of Asia. And just so you have some sense of numbers, among new cases, high is greater or equal to 18% of all TB cases. Among previously treated in Kazakhstan and parts of Russia, it's greater than or equal to 50% of previously treated cases. And in the Americas, in Peru and Argentina, it's between 12 and 30% of previously treated cases are resistant to the two most important drugs used to treat TB. You can also note that the white areas reflect no information. And this is another example of inequalities that persist. And in this case, it's the inequality of knowledge. And we really don't have as much information about certain parts of the world and quite importantly, about the parts of the world that have the highest burden of tuberculosis. So that's Africa, where there's very little data on resistance, China, where there are only subnational surveys, and India, where there are also subnational surveys. So the consequence of this is that we really don't know how big the problem is. This 440,000 figure is a best guess. You can see that only 12 countries in Africa have nationwide survey data since the year 2000, and that results in some fairly wide confidence intervals around the estimates of new cases in Africa in 2008, going from 53,000 to 110,000. We think that the prevalence of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis is between 2 and 3 times the incidence. That would be between 1 and 1.5 million cases annually. We don't actually know. There is no active surveillance going on for extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, so forms of TB that are even more resistant than MDR-TB. But there are case reports that just keep increasing the number of countries where extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis has been reported. We have similar problems with our knowledge about the mortality rate from drug-resistant TB, about the relationship between multidrug-resistant tuberculosis and HIV co-infection. Is the relationship between those two any different than between drug-susceptible TB and HIV? And trends, we really only know anything about low-prevalence rich countries. So what this leads to is really compelling headlines like this one, which actually broke an embargo before World TB Day earlier this year. The Associated Press reported that the WHO is not sure if drug-resistant TB is worsening. Not great for advocacy. And consequently, or also partially consequently and partially independently, there are tremendous gaps in strategy for management of drug-resistant tuberculosis. So the primary approach to providing treatment for drug-resistant tuberculosis in poor countries has been through a mechanism called the Green Light Committee, which was established in 2000. And you can see a summary of the two objectives of the Green Light Committee. And I would draw your attention to the second one, as that has really been the primary imperative of the Green Light Committee, which has been to prevent the development of resistance to second-line drugs by ensuring their rational drug use. So there have been real limitations on which TB programs have had access to these drugs, the argument being that programs that haven't demonstrated good TB control shouldn't be allowed to treat drug-resistant TB for fear that they will just create more. So one of the consequences of this approach has been global drug shortages, and most recently, those same drug shortages have been noted in the U.S. I borrowed this slide from Jenny Flood, and I'm grateful to her. She's in the California Department of Public Health, and at the recent advisory council meeting for the Advisory Council for the Elimination of Tuberculosis, she talked about the drug shortages also facing U.S. departments of public health in treating drug-resistant tuberculosis. And these are some of the factors that are contributing to the shortages. So there's, for most of the so-called second-line drugs, that is the drugs that are used to treat multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, there's only one quality-assured manufacturer for these drugs, and that is despite the fact that nearly all of them are off-patent and have been off-patent for years. So there's no competition. The drugs are still very expensive. Some of the raw materials used to make the drugs are in short supply. There are enormous regulatory hurdles to using these drugs, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S. In the U.S., to use these drugs, many of the drugs are used off-label, and they require going through the FDA and getting investigational new drug approval to use them. In other countries, it's importation and registration limitations that really challenge getting access. Many of the drugs have short shelf lives, and there are really very few incentives for manufacturers to make these drugs, given that most of the people who suffer from TB are not able to pay for the drugs themselves. So what do we see? So given this backdrop, you wouldn't be all that optimistic about how much treatment has occurred globally, and you would be correct. So since the Green Light Committee was established in 2000, only about 30,000 patients are estimated to have been put on quality-assured treatment for multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. And let me just remind you that that's in the same time frame that about 4 million cases of new multidrug-resistant tuberculosis and perhaps as many as 8 million total are thought to have occurred. So one of the other issues, we've talked about the drug problems, one of the other issues obviously is a shortage of resources. So just looking at this one example from 2008, this was from a WHO report and it was projected at the time, but the projection was that of the $600 million required to treat multidrug resistant tuberculosis, less than $100 million was estimated to be available in that year. So what do you get in terms of outcomes given these bad shortages of drugs and even in the few patients treated? Well, you get not very good outcomes, unfortunately. So even when the drugs are used, the poor outcomes range from about 24 to 59% of the patients. There have been a couple of recent meta-analyses, which include many more studies, but I included this subset simply because they're the only ones that look at relapse as well. So you can see that we're not having much success even when we are able to treat. It is a little bit better than Dr. Slocum's psychine elixir that was used for the consumption in the early 20th century. But just a little reminder for those of you who are less familiar, TB treatment, even standard TB treatment, requires 6 months of daily or therapy several times a week. Treatment for multidrug-resistant tuberculosis is even more burdensome, requiring up to 2 years of treatment, including daily injections. The drugs used for MDR-TB are toxic. These are drugs that were discarded for routine use in the middle of the last century. And there have been no new widely approved drugs for tuberculosis since 1963. As I mentioned, many of these drugs are used off-label, and so honestly, the caliber of study expected before new drugs are introduced now has never been performed on many of these drugs, and we really don't know what their optimal duration or combination or dosing is. Gaps in diagnostics are similar and equally bad. So the diagnosis that is most widely recommended and most widely used, because it doesn't require very sophisticated technology or electricity for that matter, is sputum smear microscopy. It's more than 125 years old, and it fails to diagnose about 50% of tuberculosis cases. Its sensitivity is even worse in children and in those co-infected with HIV. And you can see from this figure, I don't know how clearly it shows up, but the point of the figure is to show that the level of detection of this test is such that most cases can't even be diagnosed until they've suffered symptoms of the disease for about 5 months. It's also completely unable to detect resistance on its own. You need other diagnostics in addition, and the standard resistance testing takes 5 months. So one of the results of this is that only about 5% of the estimated MDR-TB burden is thought to be diagnosed annually. The vaccine situation is almost just as bad for tuberculosis. It's also very old, about 100 years old, and it doesn't prevent the most common forms of disease. It does prevent some forms of disseminated disease in children, and so it is used universally at birth in nearly all high-incidence countries. Chemoprophylaxis for TB, for latent infection, requires 9 months of daily treatment, at least the standard of care does today. And it's rarely used in resource-poor settings, and it probably does not prevent resistant TB among people who are infected with resistant organisms. And Ken alluded to this earlier, there's been a substantial gap in the funding for tuberculosis research. Estimates by the Treatment Action Group of New York are about $1.5 million shortfall annually in research for tuberculosis. So why? Why does it look this way? I mean, this is like all doom and gloom. And one of the biggest reasons, again, I've alluded to this already, Ken described it beautifully, the people who suffer from TB are not those who are most often heard. So the picture on the top left is from a shanty town in Lima, Peru, where Partners in Health has been working since 1994. And you can see that those are not the conditions that lead to strong advocacy. Just a reminder, using the World Mapper distribution of TB, that most of the cases are in poor settings. So with respect to our perspective in the US, there have been lots of false announcements or pronouncements of the end of infectious diseases in the US. You can see this figure shows the decline of typhoid and tuberculosis in the US, and two claims that we were nearing the end here. You can see that Dr. Margaret Chan, the Director General of the World Health Assembly, actually in 2008 said that we really basically have all we need for tuberculosis. She was talking about the very same tools that I've just described to you. And in contrast, she was positive about the ability to develop a complex treatment like antiretroviral therapy, but acknowledged that that the progress to date was inadequate. Most recently, Zeke Emanuel, the special advisor to President Obama, visited an MDR-TB treatment hospital in Ethiopia and was really struck by what he considered the sort of cost ineffectiveness of that approach, and that really efforts should be placed on diseases like malaria, or efforts where one could have more of an impact. I think it's probably unfair to compare malaria and TB for a couple of reasons. One, they both kill a lot of people, and it seems highly inappropriate to draw resources from one to treat the other, to suggest that that's where resources should come from. And two, malaria is a disease that can be treated in a matter of days, not months, and so interventions are likely to be much cheaper. So just a note on this whole cost-effectiveness argument that underlies a lot of the decisions in public health is that it is intrinsically unequal. The thresholds used by the World Health Organization per recommendations of this International Commission on Macroeconomics and Health and by many other groups value human life differentially depending on the gross domestic product of the country from which somebody comes. So what this results in is different decisions about whether interventions are cost effective or not. So very perversely, in a WHO subregion with very high child mortality and high adult mortality, cost-effective intervention would be one that costs between about $1,700 and $5,100, whereas in a low child and low adult mortality region, you could go up to about $120,000 per disability-adjusted life year saved, and that would still be cost-effective. So enough of the doom and gloom. I just wanted to finish by showing a few slides of an alternative approach. So Partners in Health has been working with a community-based partner in Lima, Peru, Socios en Salud, since 1994, in the shanty towns of northern Lima, Peru. They began working with a group of community health workers in 1994, and the thought in their beginnings of working in this community was that they would do anything but TB because Peru was cited as having a model tuberculosis program. But cases of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis that wasn't responding to standard treatment, began to emerge in families and whole communities, and they had no choice but to develop an intervention. So the approach was a really patient-centered intervention that involved collaborations with institutions both inside Peru and outside Peru. Most notably, the Massachusetts State Laboratory Institute provided all of the drug susceptibility testing in the early years of this project. It included an ambulatory program, and this is a bit of a shout out to John Spavaro, as Randall referred to earlier. Chemical quarantine was the term. So keeping patients out of hospitals where infection control measures are not very good unless there was a medical reason for them to be hospitalized. It also reduces the burden on the families if the patients can stay at home and don't have to be out of the home for a year or 2 years. it's a very nurse-centered focus with consultation with internists and pulmonologists. It involved providing access to thoracic surgery for those patients who really needed that sort of adjunctive surgery, adjunctive treatment to chemotherapy. Why isn't this? And for patients who are living in extremely crowded conditions and presented transmission risks to family members, improving the living conditions was also part of the intervention. And income-generating activities as well provided opportunities for patients and community members to be able to provide more support, especially for those who had lost working time due to their disease. So the results of this intervention in at least a subset of patients that were treated between 1999 and 2002 showed that among those who had the least prior exposure, so the column on the farthest to the right is with the least prior exposure, about 80% were cured. You can see that the good outcomes decrease with more prior exposure. Peru, the National TB Program in Peru has taken this project and expanded it nationwide. More than 10,000 patients have been treated for multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. Cure is occurring in more than 60% of patients, and they're moving toward universal access to a diagnosis and cure of drug-resistant TB. And this figure just shows a little bit about what's happened in Peru. I draw your attention to the lower right-hand corner, which just illustrates that although almost 80% of the funds for this work came from external sources in 2001, only about 20% of the resources for treating multidrug-resistant tuberculosis came from external sources in 2008. And just as a final reminder, I show you in the lower right-hand corner what the GLC has been able to do, and I note that the units on the y-axis are in individual patients. The other figure is access to antiretroviral therapy globally between in a similar time period, and I note that those units are in millions of patients. So just in very, very brief summary, I personally do see lots of cause for outrage, as Ken already alluded to, that these diseases disproportionately affect the world's poor. The tools are really, really outdated and unlikely to lead to sustained control. The continued use of these cost-effectiveness thresholds reinforces existing inequalities. And it is pretty clear at this point that a free market will not solve the technological problems for tuberculosis. And we do have some examples of comprehensive community-based care that have permitted scale-up of complex interventions. Thank you.
A couple questions?
Yeah, go ahead. It's a very good question. So the question was, is it possible for governments to produce the drugs? It is possible. There has not been a lot of interest in doing that. There are a few generic manufacturers that have been producing, but they have been extremely frustrated by the lack of demand because this green light committee has functioned as a real bottleneck. And I think these generic manufacturers would like to be producing a lot more than they are, and it is possible, say, for Brazil to begin to produce drugs as well. Yeah, go ahead. So Bill's going to address that one. We'll leave you in suspense for just a few more minutes. Yes, go ahead. So Bill is also going to include that in. Bill Berman, who's the next speaker, will also speak about that. I'm leaving him with the good news. Well, quasi. Jennifer?
So how do we bridge those gaps?
So the question was, how do we bridge the gaps between the funding that's needed and the funding that's allocated? Well, I mean, I think that's obviously a very, very long, complicated question, but I think there are a couple of shorter answers. So the Global Fund is a mechanism that has provided an enormous resource for global public health in the last several years. You know, something that I never could have imagined when I started working in this field. It is not used to the extent that it could be for multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, and it is also not used to the extent that it could be for operational research to support testing some of these new tools or new strategies. So that's one answer. There have also been, I think, some fairly substantial efforts to add tuberculosis and multi-drug resistant tuberculosis in a more substantial way to single disease approaches like PEPFAR, and that's another opportunity. NIH is showing a willingness to begin to use some of the resources that have been developed for AIDS clinical trials, both of drugs and vaccines and of microbicides for other infectious diseases. So those are some examples, but I'd be very interested in your thoughts on that, Jennifer. So one more question? Yeah. Sorry. I'm sorry, I had called on her, forgive me. But you can catch me afterwards. Right. So that's, again, a very good question. The question was about the Green Light Committee and what sort of movement is happening there. And I wasn't completely fair to the Green Light Committee, and I should be. It was started really as a way to test out this strategy and to get pilot projects up and running and to see if they could be done. And it was really extremely useful for doing that. The problem is now that there's this enormous gap between the number of patients being put on treatment and those being recognized as needing treatment. And so there are extensive discussions underway about trying to change the mechanisms and trying to understand what would be a more appropriate model. So many of us have argued for a model more like antiretroviral therapy, where the emphasis is really on getting numbers of patients on treatment. And of course, you want to do it as responsibly as possible, but the emphasis has really been on protecting the drugs, not on getting the patients on treatment, and so looking at mechanisms that could get more patients on treatment. So there have been conversations about regional green light committees in each of the WHO regions. There have been conversations about completely eliminating any sort of gatekeeper like that and just having programs apply to the Global Fund and other funding sources like they do for any other disease and not having special review processes. It is still very much up in the air. I'm hopeful that there will be a solution by the end of this year or early next year. Thank you.